Dublin's Talking Sport with Ken Doherty and Reggie Corrigan.
Sponsored by InsureMyVan.ie. Reduce your price, not your cover.
Ladies and gentlemen, at the start of the fourth round, Gordon Flair having retired, the winner, Michael Carew.
Big kick. Kinsella Quinn heads on. Oh, surely this time for Keane. And Ireland do it. Robbie Keane.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
Hello and a very good morning to you. I'm Reggie Corrigan and welcome to Dublin's Talking Sport on Sunshine 106.8 with thanks to InsureMyVan.ie. Well, as always, loads to come on this morning's show. We'll be talking to Dave Dean on the Racing Hour podcast to discuss all the latest news from horse racing and also to preview this weekend's races and share with his lucky 15 in snooker. We'll be joined by our very own Ken Doherty live from Milton Keynes as he speaks about the 2021 Gibraltar Open, which is currently taking place in the Marshall Arena. In rugby, I'll be talking to former Ireland and Leinster hooker Shane Byrne about last weekend's results in the 2021 Guinness Six Nations. And we'll also look ahead to this weekend's Pro 14 fixtures, and all four provinces are in action. In football, we'll be talking to Alan Cawley of Cawley's Cup as he gives us a preview of the weekend's fixtures on the Premier League, and we look into next week's games in both the Champions League and the Europa League. We've got some special guests on the show this morning, obviously following the controversy with Gordon Elliott during the week. We'll be speaking to journalist and broadcaster Johnny Ward about that particular situation and the latest sanctions that have been taken against him by the Irish Horse Racing Board. And we will also be speaking to Vicky Wall, who is the Meath All-Ireland winner and Intermediate Player of the Year, about the difficulties we're texting us faced in the year, but also the success that they've had both at club and inter-county level. So as always, you can get in touch with us on the show by texting us on 08711 55777 or WhatsApp us on 087 188 1068. And of course, don't forget, we're on Facebook, Dublin's Talking Sport, Twitter at Sport1068, and Instagram, Dublin's Talking Sport. So as always, it's time to look at the papers. Delighted to be joined in studio by Blaine. Morning, Blaine. How are you?
Good morning, Reg. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. It's been a busy week. Plenty going on around the place. Enjoying different bits of sport this week. How about yourself?
Yeah, same. Yeah. Yeah. That's all I can say, Reg.
There's
a lot in it at the moment, and we've got a jam-packed show today, don't we?
Excellent. What are we talking about first? What are we looking at?
We're looking at the games, the Premier League matches that are kicking off today. So we've got a early match between Arsenal and Burnley, and Arsenal are hoping to secure a back-to-back away win in the Premier League this lunchtime. Mm-hmm. And then Southampton have just taken a point from a possible 18 ahead of their 3 o'clock start away to bottom side Sheffield United. That's mad to think, Reg, that Southampton have just dropped in form. Like, I know back in, was it October or December, they were on top of the league, and then I remember their tweet, they said, it's like, stop the count. I remember that kind of referring to Donald Trump they were, which I thought was very, very funny. But it's been crazy how much their form has dipped.
It's been a strange second half of the league. There's no question about it when you look at the likes of them, and when you look at the likes of Liverpool and what's happening to them and other teams. And for other teams, indeed, it's been a good second half as well. You know, they've moved themselves up the standings. So there's no question about it. It's been an interesting second half, I think, is the best way to describe it, I suppose, with City just staking their claim and putting everything to bed because they had such a bad start, you know.
As you said, it's a season of two halves, isn't it, Reg? People who were brilliant in the first half seem to be kind of deteriorating now, and then people who were not so great in the first half are just, you know, bouncing up on form now, as you said, City, Chelsea, all those, which is great to see. There's a West Midlands clash between Aston Villa and Wolves at 5:30 today, and then the last game of the day is Leicester, and they are seeking a first win in 3 games as they go to Brighton from 8. And obviously Leicester want to, you know, try and remain in that top 4, trying to get into the Champions League next season. And the thing about it is, it's actually a funny fact that Leicester have actually not dropped out of the top 4 since they have actually gotten into the top 4 this season. Mm-hmm. So they're one of the only teams that have actually remained in the top 4 all season. So, you know, they want to start getting back on form, and I know it's very, very difficult because Leicester have just been riddled with injuries. Oh, like it looks like they said the 9 of their first team players are out, so it's quite difficult on Leicester, and no wonder they have kind of dropped in form.
that's a lot of injuries, and it's quite an incredible achievement to stay in that top four, considering that, I mean, if you look at injuries as being the main complaint that have been levelled against the Liverpool team, in particular in defence, for Leicester to maintain that form is pretty amazing.
Absolutely. We've got some good news anyway on the managerial front. So Mick McCarthy, the ex-Ireland manager, stretched his unbeaten start at Cardiff as Cardiff boss to 11 matches. So Cardiff had have ended the night a point outside the Champions League playoff spot. So it's great news.
Yeah, he's done very well, Mick, there since he's moved over. It's amazing when he comes into these clubs, you know, kind of comes in somewhat under the radar, but he's does an amazing job at fixing them up, and it seems to be come in and gets the short fix done quickly, if you know what I mean. And then I suppose they look to more long term things then, and he's out. But you know, that's an amazing record, 11 matches, absolutely incredible by him.
He's almost like Big Sam, Reg, isn't he? You know, they bring Big Sam in to get in, to fix it, to get out of relegation, as you can see with West Brom. And Mick McCarthy, he does that. He's on a good roll for a few matches. And as you say, when it comes to long term, then you're like, I don't know if we can keep to him now.
Exactly, they never seem to keep with them after that. So, because he can make a career out of going around fixing clubs. That's not a bad job to have either.
That's it. We've got some really nice news to hear, actually, Reg. Drogheda United have actually announced a new name for their home ground for the 2021 season in the League of Ireland. So the Drogs will play their home games at the Head in the Game Park for their return to the Premier Division this season. So the decision was made to help promote mental health awareness. I think that's a lovely, lovely thing that they've done, Drogheda, just to, you know, kind of, with it being such a tough year, both for everyone and, you know, sport as well, I think it's a really, really nice gesture to put out there that they're going to be renaming their stadium for a year.
Okay, that's a good move by them. It could be called the Head in the Hands Park a few times.
Oh, no.
Don't go their way. There's loads of interpretation the way that can be picked up, but it is a good move by them just to help promote the mental health awareness. So I see in rugby as well, Joey Carberry making another cameo for Munster and getting there last night. They managed to get a victory just 12 minutes from time, with Carberry getting a penalty that saw them beat Connacht by 20 points to 17. And of course, that means that Munster are through to they're the first of the teams through to the final of the Pro 14. With two games to spare in Conference B, they've finished top of that group. So it'll be up to Leinster then to meet them in the final. But they have to go to Ulster tonight. They're the only challengers in Conference A to Leinster are Ulster. So I suppose if they can get the job done tonight, it's done. So they'll be certainly going to try and get that organised. During the week as well, Keane Healy signed a one-year extension to his RFU contract, added to Peter O'Mahony, who also signed a two-year extension to his. The one-year deal fee for Healy will bring him up to the end of the 2021 season. And he's Ireland's most capped prop. 107 times he's worn the green jersey to date. Some achievement, an amazing career from a wonderful player for Ireland, Keane Healy. Another year to go, so that's good.
That's it. I think one of the main topics that we'll be speaking about today now, Reg, is the horse race, and obviously with Gordon Elliott and, you know, his suspension. But there are some news now about... So Denise Sneezy Foster is set to step in as a licensed trainer at Gordon Elliott's Calentry Yard.
It's going to be very, very interesting to see how this all unfolds. I'm going to be talking to Johnny Ward, of course, journalist and broadcaster, about the decision yesterday for Gordon Elliott and his ban. But it is going to be very, very interesting to see how the Calentry Yard manages during this period. Of course, horses that have been trained by Elliot, they must be transferred to other trainers if they want to, and that's by Monday, if they want to compete in Cheltenham. So that's there's a lot of organisational stuff involved in that, and of course, what damage is that going to do to the stud? So I'll be discussing all of that with Johnny and trying to get to the bottom of all of that. See as well, Patrick Mullins has decided not to turn professional so he won't be riding in Cheltenham. Yeah. So, I mean, the rules have been changed. It means that amateur jockeys can't ride in Britain, because they put a ban on that. So he was thinking about turning pro, but he's decided not to do that now. So of course, Patrick, the son of Willie Mullins. So interesting decision by him not to do that. And I kind of can understand it as well, because one hell of a tough profession, professional that's jockey, that's for sure.
Absolutely, and it's a tough loss as well not to see him racing Cheltenham too.
Absolutely, yeah. Big decision, tough decision for him to do that. Interesting one. I kind of forgotten that whole thing about amateurs not being allowed rides. So that decision in its own right is a bit of an interesting one. So you can see why, you can the pros and cons for that. Safety being the main issue, of course. I see in golf, Rory McIlroy is just 2 shots off the lead heading into the third day of the Arnold Palmer. So he shot a 71 yesterday to reach halfway at Bay Hill at 7 under par. Park Harrington would begin his third round on level par.
Absolutely.
That's good going for Rory.
That's it. And actually, there's some nice news as well that Cavan's Leona Maguire is actually tied for 6th place heading into the weekend at the Drive-On Championship in Florida. So, second round 71, keeping her within 6 shots of the American joint leaders of Austin Ernst and Jennifer Kupcho.
Excellent stuff. Okay, look, there's loads coming tonight in athletics as well. Yeah. Very, very exciting. Bandon sprinter Phil Healy is going into the 400 metre final, having won both her heat and semi-final, so huge excitement around that. That final is on at 7:25 this evening Irish time, so put that in your phone and make note of it, because it's hugely exciting. Phil Healy with massive form at the moment, like I said, winning both her heat and her semi-final, so incredible stuff. Be brilliant to see a medal there in the indoor championships. It will be so lovely to see. We also have Nadia Power competing in the semi-finals of the women's 800 metre, and Mark English and Keane McPhillips going to the semi-finals of the men's 800. And just before midday, Sarah Lavin is in the heats of the women's 60 metre hurdles as well.
That's it, Reg. And it's great to see, and it's I know there's been a lot of discussion around whether the Olympics will go ahead this year, you know, with obviously the coronavirus, but seeing how good Ireland have been doing in the European Indoor Athletics Championships this week, you know, you're kind of hoping that we can see these athletes perform in the Olympics this year, because we don't want to wait another 4 years, because I feel like if the Olympics don't go ahead this year, it'll just be cancelled and then it'll just go on to the next Olympics then after that. So it would be very hard to see these guys not, performing in the Olympics.
Not being able to showcase their work, but it's going to be very hard to see how that Olympics is going to go ahead.
That's it.
That's the reality of it. But look, we'll see. We won't write it off yet.
No.
In snooker, Ken disappointed during the week. He was going great against Selby.
He was.
And he just fell down a little bit then. But so he's out of it. But Mark Allen is the last Irishman standing in the Gibraltar Open. The Antrimon is facing Iran's Hussein Vafai in the last 16 at Milton Keynes. So the first 2-4 will progress to the quarterfinals. So we're going to be catching up with Ken a little bit later on and getting all of the news from over there and those matches coming up. Anything else for me, Blaine?
No, nothing, Reg. I think we should just get started and get cracking into this very full show for you.
Now we're turning our attention to horse racing, and of course the news yesterday that after a week of speculation and public opinion, the Irish Horse Racing Board have reached a decision to suspend Gordon Elliott for 12 months and suspend 6 months of that and fine him €15,000. I'm delighted to be joined on the line now by Johnny Ward, broadcaster and journalist. Good morning, Johnny. How are you?
Good morning, Reggie. Not too bad, thanks.
Good. Look, it's a tough morning. I mean, the results came out of that. It was very, very closely monitored, that case yesterday, the meeting of the IHRB, of course, and the decision on Gordon. We all know the pictures during the week and everything that came out about it. And they came down with a fairly heavy decision in the end, but I suppose they were left with little choice, really, were they?
They were left with little choice, and, so much of this, Reggie, was about optics, really, in the sense that if this hadn't blown up on social media and in the wider media, Elliot might have gotten a lesser sentence, because, you know, he could quite fairly argue, you know, in front of the IHRB yesterday, that there wasn't a precedent here, that he hadn't actually committed any crime against a horse. You know, the horse that he was seen sitting upon had already deceased, and that it was entirely really an image thing and an optics thing. But I think the IHRB had to be cognizant of the fact that this was a PR nightmare for racing. There's no getting away from that. I mean, this was on this was on CNN, it was on the BBC, it was, you know, all over the press here all week in Ireland, but more so in you know, other jurisdictions. And Elliot is a big name, and so I think it had to be cognizant of that Elliot had made a big mistake. And so he got 6 months of a ban with a further 6 months suspended, and so he's going to serve 6 months at least. And Denise Foster is going to take over the license of the yard at Clintra House. And Elliot, I would think and hope, just kind of has to take stock of the ramifications of this. And there are, you know, really wider ramifications as well in terms of what you can do anymore when everyone has a smartphone. You know, I was sent an image of Gordon probably having had a few beers at a match in looked like it was Lansdowne Road or Crow Park during the week as well. That probably was, you know, taken when he wasn't even looking and was taken by somebody else. And when you're in the public eye now, you basically can't do anything. And I think Gordon has had a really, really hard week on a personal level, and I hope people support him, because it was horrible what he went through, as much as he made a big mistake.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and it is extremely difficult. I found it interesting myself in the judgment that the decision was based around him, let's call it bringing the game into disrepute, you know, bringing the sport into disrepute. And it wasn't around actually any form of cruelty or... So if you're an animal welfare activist, for example, you'll be saying, oh, these animals are treated badly and they're this and that and the other. But the decision wasn't made anything around the animal. It was all about bringing the sport into disrepute.
Yeah, I think the BHA in Britain kind of went on a bit of a solo really last week on Sunday when it said that, you know, I think it described the image as shocking. And Elliot then had a four-timer Punchdown on Monday, but at that stage, after the meeting on Monday, the BHA decided that it would bar all his... British runners pending the IHRB investigation. And there's been a lot of disquiet in Ireland about the BHA, what it did, because, you know, Elliot was entitled to a fair hearing, and nobody can say he wasn't. I guess the problem for the BHA was Cheltenham was looming, and Cheltenham was not a good PR episode whatsoever for racing last year, because I'm sure you remember well that, you know, the pandemic was probably the most, I suppose, seminal week in the pandemic, or certainly in 2020, when, you know, I think Ireland's first death from the COVID might have been around that time. And as much as Liverpool played Atletico Madrid on the Wednesday, Cheltenham was really used as a scapegoat, I think, for a lot of people who were angry and worried. And that was just not good PR for Cheltenham at all. And for this to appear, not coincidentally by any means, 2 weeks before Cheltenham, was basically a PR nightmare for the BHA, and it wanted something to be done. I think it was absolutely insistent that Gordon Elliott's name was not going to be on any Cheltenham race card because of all the negative publicity that would entail. And so the IHRB acted quite fast, and I think it itself has been under pressure because, you know, there was a Viking Horde episode in Tramore where the horse was drugged, and his trainer Charles Burns got a 6-month ban for basically leaving the stable unattended. But there was, you know, very negative PR for the IHRB on that. There are other issues as well that have come to the fore that have put it under pressure. And I think yesterday it was under extreme pressure to come up with a stern judgment. And it appears that Elliot, you know, is quite satisfied with how it worked out, and he's taken it on the chin.
Yeah, I have to say I was impressed in the sense that he... he seems to be... I think he's taking the right stance in it, that, you know, the original response was bad, let's say, you know, the excuse they tried to come up with of why the photo was taken, that was in haste and didn't sound good. But the way he's taken it now, it's kind of like, look, I'm taking this, it was my fault, it's my responsibility, I will you know, I'll deal with this, and you have to admire him for taking that stance on it.
Yeah, you know, I've written a piece in the Currency today, and I've a piece in the business foes tomorrow about this, and it'll deal with a few of the issues you mentioned there, Reggie, but so much of the world now is about optics. You know, the sport you're most familiar with, rugby, will have a major PR battle going down the line in terms of concussion and stuff like that. And Racing's PR battle at the moment is really great. And whoever advised Elliot to issue that statement, that it was nearly 20-12, I think, yeah, on Sunday night, badly let him down, because I almost would forgive him more for the madness, albeit the instant madness of the stupidity of what he did in that photo, as opposed to a premeditated statement that took place roughly a day and a half after the image started circulating in social media. So I think he dug a really big hole for himself, and people got even angrier after reading that statement. Yeah. Whereas then he gave an interview with David Jennings in the Racing Post. David Jennings actually called to his house on Monday, and I think he spoke to him later on in the week, where he was far more contrite. He was clearly sorry. He was basically in tears, and this was him not being prompted by somebody else. Yeah. But actually, he's an honest sort of a bloke. He's rough around the edges to a point, but he's very honest. Yeah. And I think he at that stage realised that this was bad. And like, when you have the image then of Anne Boleyn, and this is the equivalent of, you know, this is probably the best horse you'll ever have, leaving the yard in a horse box, yeah, leaving a stable empty, it conjured up sad images. And I think it was a bit like when I talked about the pandemic, the swing in the public's attitude during Cheltenham last year. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, the Monday before Cheltenham, people weren't really saying anything. By the Wednesday, everyone who was at Cheltenham was like a pariah. It's funnily enough, this week, there was a mad change in opinion towards Elliot as the week went on, because people did look at it at a human level and have sympathy for him.
Well, that human level, I think, is something we've lost in society in cases. I really do. And it's trial by social media. And
absolutely.
You know, it's in everything. It's in every walk of life. God forbid you might ever make any step out of line in this world, because you'll be hauled across the coals on social media, and it drives me crazy at times. And I do feel,
yeah,
Johnny, I do feel there was a sinister element at play here, and it was noted in the report as well from the IHRB. I mean, somebody had this photo and leaked it at a pretty, you know, convenient time in terms of 2 weeks before Cheltenham. There's more to this than meets the eye.
Totally, Reggie. Like, you could probably write a book on the last week that Gordon has had, but there's been an awful lot of, you know, speculation on WhatsApp in racing circles about his personal life, really, over the last month or so, it was really of no interest to me, but people like salacious rumours and all this. And Gordon then had to wake up on Sunday morning knowing essentially that somebody was out to get him, because that was what the IHRB even said, which was an unusual step for it to say that, but it mentioned the word sinister, as you said there. Somebody was out to get him. And then when an image appeared of a young Rob James on another dead horse, I think that was Tuesday morning, you're wondering, well, like, what's going on here? Is this a conspiracy against a man or a conspiracy against a sport? Because I think there was a real paranoia in the race community then. It's like, what more is going to come out here? And just on a human level, you mentioned that there. I think that's very, very true. I frankly think social media is a bit of a cesspit when it comes to stuff like this, because, you know, it's trial by social media, but people don't really care about the human cost of it. But Gordon Elliott, not only was all what he built up was basically under threat, and all the 80-odd staff he has or whatever, and all the horses he had, all of this was, you know, up in doubt or whatever. He also kind of had to realise that somebody was out to get him here, and you wonder, what else is going to come here, and why is this happening to me? And this was being played out in the media and in social media, as opposed to among your mates, if somebody's out to get you. So I had a lot of sympathy for him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a lot of, and I'll call it rubbish now at this stage, because it's been proven since when Caroline Flack committed suicide, and the Be Kind movement came out around social media and all this kind of stuff, and it lasted for all of a few weeks where everybody was hashtagging Be Kind. It was very, very quickly forgotten, and then straight away going back to the cesspit, as you called it, and I agree with, of social media and what it is, where everybody jumps on everything. Now, that's not in any way to defend. I mean, obviously, it was a stupid thing that happened with the horse. We all get that. You know, but the horse died on the gallops and had a heart attack. It wasn't like, you know, that they had beaten it to death or anything like that, you know. I mean, it's, you know, there's all of those things to look into as well. So, yeah, social media and all that goes along with it. And as you said, it almost felt like the powers that be had to be seen to do something and take a very, very firm stance.
They did, and you know, this image was circulated and retweeted and so on, with no possibility whatsoever that everybody involved in its circulation knew that it was true. And I have a major issue with that. And Twitter and Facebook, obviously, you know, there will be issues down the line in terms of their role in the media and their role as facilitators of media, and if they put up something that isn't true. Now, this turned out to be true, but Elliot's reputation was almost, you know, it was somewhat ruined before the truth of this had actually been established, which was kind of somewhere on Saturday evening or that. And it was just, I think a lot of people in lockdown as well, Reggie, they are kind of angry. A lot of people are online far more than they should be. They're on their phones and they want something to be angry about. And Elliot was that something to be angry about. And it was really, it was about optics. And another issue here is this photo was over 2 years old. So like, we should all pretty much be afraid of anything we did in the past or any photo that was taken, which we mightn't even know was taken, because it could always resurface. And I think this was initially shared as a Snapchat by somebody else. So how much Gordon even knew about it is up for debate. And, you know, he's had to suffer an awful lot, because you imagine waking up in the morning and wondering, Christ, did I do something 5 years ago now that could be on social media tonight?
Yeah. Like, I mean, if you make any sort of headway in life, that, like, these things can be brought back against you. I agree with you. Or even, like, let's face it, some things, it's not hard to Photoshop things nowadays. You just, there can be a campaign against you and then you're gone. But I'm not saying that's the case here, but I'm just making the point. I suppose that the next thing we need to look at, Johnny, is to work out, what does it mean for Gordon? I mean, obviously, there's massive financial implications with all of this. We see sponsors have pulled out, Betfair being the most obvious one initially, but then plenty of others as well. People removing horses from yards, and some owners standing by him. But you know, like this, like what, one thing I will say about Gordon, he worked his way up. You know, I mean, it's from the ground up. This stable and Colintra has been, you know, a success story, but it's pretty precarious, that industry. And, you know, as he said himself, you don't make a lot of money out of the horse business. It must be on a knife edge now about the stable's survival.
I think he'll be okay, Reggie. You know, it's kind of hard, because I don't know, my kind of attitude to it was swinging a lot during the week, and you know, you're caught up in this kind of bubble and there's a lot of hysteria. But you know, I think what we can say is he's 6 months out of the game, where he's not going to attend a race meeting or a point-to-point. Now, we saw Charles Burns got his six-month suspension, and Charles Burns' neighbour now has a horse of his called Those Days Are Gone, who won on Friday night, literally an hour maybe before, or an hour after that the IHRB brought out its judgment on Elliot. So it was kind of a nice timing, the sense of that trainers can be banned, but their horses can still win when trained by somebody else. And in fairness to Gordon, you know, apart from Cheveley Park, and obviously Betfair did what it was inevitably going to do, apart from Cheveley Park, his owners have pretty much been loyal to him, and I kind of get the feeling that they probably will stay loyal to him. I think they will rally around him, as much as the loss of the Cheveley Park Octet or however amount of horses there were is really, really damaging. I think he'll be okay, and I think he needs to take time to take stock of his own life as well, and the fact that he's 43 now, he probably needs to take a level of maturity that befits his stature and role in the business and in sporting life in Ireland. And I think he referenced that a little bit in his own statement last night, where he said, I'm not the young lad who was at Tony Martin's anymore.
I found that interesting. All right, it's been a stern lesson in growing up, or you know, it seems very hard, like such a public you know, trial, as you said, by social media. It must be hard to take, and you know, let's call it, you know, you'd hope that somebody's keeping an eye on him too, because it's a lot to take. It's a lot of pressure on one person's own mental health.
Well, Mark Enright, you know, who struggled with depression and has been quite open about that, Galway Plate winning jockey who would have ridden for Elliot.
Yeah.
I'm actually off Twitter, Reggie, now, so I only noticed this maybe 3 or 4 days after he tweeted it. But he basically spoke about, in one tweet, he spoke about his own mental health issues, and he said, don't underestimate the relevance of this in terms of Elliot. And I was very conscious of this during the week because the reports I was getting back was that Elliot was in a really bad way. He was crying in front of his staff saying that he needed them more than ever. But there was Robert James as well, the jockey, who's, you know, the video optically to my mind was worse than Elliot's. This is something that took place 5 years ago when he was a young kid. You know, we've all done stupid things in the past, but this surfaced and he was in a dark place as well. He was, you know, he was really, really sad over what he did. And I was in a situation where I might send Gordon Elliott a text and 3 or 4 hours later I'd be kind of slating him on the radio. But I did have to try to do my job whilst at the same time, you know, I'm very, very conscious of mental health battles and the stuff that social media, I mentioned Caroline Flack, the damages of social media. So you're absolutely right. It's been a very, very dark week for those two lads. And I don't think either of them deserves to be in that place over either image, to be honest. I think it was, you're talking about moments of stupidity, but, you know, I was genuinely worried about their welfare.
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more. Johnny, it's been wonderful talking to you. I really enjoyed that chat and thank you for that insight. And as you said, I am concerned about their welfare too. And, you know, whatever about animal welfare, we have to think about the human side of all of these stories as well and the repercussions for the people involved, the greater people involved in the stable itself, the family and everybody else around these people. So, okay, the decision has been made. I just hope people can put it to bed now and leave it at that and not continue on and continue just trying to make more and more out of it. Let's hope that people can move on to the next level and accept that the decision has been made, accept that responsibility has been taken for this by all parties, both the Horse Racing Board and Gordon Elliott himself and the people around him, and let's move on. I hope that that's what happens. So, Johnny, thanks so much for chatting to me about that this morning.
Not at all, Reggie.
Cheers, take care. That's Johnny Ward there, broadcaster and journalist, of course, giving his opinion on that decision that was made yesterday on Gordon Elliott and his 12-month ban, which has been suspended to 6 months. Okay, time to return our attention now to our Lucky 15 and horse racing. And, of course, Dave Weldon. Good morning, Dave. How are you?
Not bad, Reg. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. Yeah, indeed. Plenty going on this week, racing-wise. I'll talk to you a little bit towards the end about what I was just talking to Johnny about there with Gordon Elliott, of course.
Yep.
But a couple of other pieces. Interesting to see Patrick Mullins. He's decided to turn down the opportunity to go pro. Kind of understandable in many ways. I'd say it's a tough profession to go into.
Yeah. I don't even think it's that, Reg. I think he's happy with his amateur status and he's the leading amateur and he set so many records. He's kind of based. Willie Mullins' dad is an assistant trainer now as well and all that, and the rules around turn professional is you have to do it for a year and you can't have more than 25 winners. So it's going to be hard for Patrick to not have 25 winners in a year, which means you have to stay pro for another year and he'd want to go back and ride in all them amateur races and stuff.
Yeah.
The following year when things return to normal. So it's a completely understandable decision. It's a shame now he won't be going over to Cheltenham. He would have had some book of rides even outside the old amateur races.
Yeah.
It's like Sechargia and the Champion Hurdle and Mellon and Ryanair. So, pretty understandable decision, but a shame to have a lot of his talent not there.
Just to clear it up for all our listeners, the British Horse Racing Association made a ruling that amateurs couldn't ride in...
It was part... I think it was actually Boris Johnson who made the call that amateurs couldn't ride, and then the BHA put it in. Sorry, it was obviously the BHA put it in, but it was that level of restriction from the UK that won't be released until the 29th of March. So it just falls after Cheltenham. So they're hoping to be back for Aintree for the Fox Hunters and a couple other amateur races there.
Okay, that makes sense. I get that now. Okay, what have we got this week then? We're going to have a look at some something to lift the spirits. Let's get a few winners.
Yeah, hopefully so. There's plenty racing on today. There's Kelso and Doncaster Newbury and Navan today and a couple of good meetings tomorrow. We're going to go to Kelso and Doncaster and Newbury for the Lucky 15. A couple of good races. Kelso especially put on a really good card. It's their feature meeting of the year. And there's a couple of bonuses if you win here at Kelso today and then win at Cheltenham in a couple of weeks' time. So we'll start at the 1:30 and my draw go for the Skeletons. We've got a 15-8, 7-4 shot in the 1:30 at Kelso. Unbeaten over hurdles in two starts so far. And he's regarded very highly by the yard. Skipping Cheltenham for this and possibly Aintree, just look after maybe a better horse next year. But I think he'll take all the beating here. Mike Drogo in the 1:30 at Kelso.
Okay, no problem.
Then we go skip over to Newbury for the 150, Killer Clown for Adam Wedge and Emma Lavelle. Won a really decent race over at Kempton over Christmas. And this is another stepping stone for him. He's going to be a really good horse in a few years' time. He's 4-1. I think he's still well handicapped and likely have more to come. That's Killer Clown in the 150 at Newbury.
Excellent stuff.
Okay. Back over to Kelso. Grand National favourite Cloth Cap is running in the 240 at Kelso. It's around 11-4. He's third favourite at the moment. I think he should be clear favourite. He won the Ladbrokes Chase, the big handicap in November at Newbury. It's Grand National favourite. He's 11-4 here. Good drying ground. It will suit him perfectly. He's against a couple of old horses here who have had their day in the sun, and his star is only rising now. So Cloud Cap in the 240 at around 11-4 in the 240 at Kelso.
Okay.
And then finally over to Doncaster for 255 and Zoffy for Philip Hobbs and Richard Johnson. It's a tricky enough race, but this lad, if he improves his jumping just even a little bit, he'd be right there involved. He's a good win, two starts ago. And he was a bit sloppy the last day, but if he should improve on that, it's only his fourth start, so he's more than entitled to improve his jumping over fences. And that's off in the 255.
Great stuff. Okay, we'll have a look at those and see where we go with that. With the news of everything that's happened during the week, has Cheltenham been affected prices-wise? Are we seeing any changes in the market, move in the market?
Not really. There was a few moves on Tuesday and stuff like that when it wasn't really known what was going to happen with the likes of Envoy Allen and stuff. He drifted out a little bit, but he's hardened up again since, so there hasn't really been much movement there. Now, there's a few few ideas of how this is going to affect them horses, the eight horses that were moved from Gordon Elliott to Willie Mullins and Henry de Bromheads, because horses get spooked so easily, the thoroughbred breed. So it's hard to know what's going to happen, if they're going to perform fully. Hopefully they do, and hopefully they can live up to expectations. It's such a strange time for them horses now, because they'll move to a different yard and move to Cheltenham for another week, which is a lot of change for them. It's hard to know what's going to happen with them horses.
Okay, well, we'll just keep an eye on the prices and see what happens. Of course, we did speak to Johnny about it. We don't want to go too much more into it, but I suppose the decision was inevitable, really, that there was going to be a fairly lengthy ban for Gordon Elliott, given what we saw during the week.
It was, yeah. Like, it was very. I've gone through fits, Reggie, of being completely angry at the whole situation to just feeling complete sadness for Gordon and the whole team down there. Like, I've been in Coventry numerous times, and it's a fantastic place, fantastic facilities and everything. But I think as soon as this picture came out, you thought that this Gordon's going to have a long ban here.
Yeah.
But kind of the way it happened then during the week, and BHA stepping in and banning his horse, has kind of sped things up as well. Yeah. Probably not to a good extent, but from public perception.
Does it feel a little bit overly harsh in your mind?
I don't think so, Reg. Yeah. I don't think you can tell what damage this is going to do for raising this image. Between now and Aintree and Punchestown, this image is going to be used everywhere, by people who want to see racing finished and the industry closed. So that damage itself is probably worthy of a ban. A few people I talked to would see him banned longer. I think 6 months is fine. It'll give him time to go and sort himself out as well and get himself in a good mental space, which he needs to do. So, and hopefully we can get past this now as an industry and move forward, because it's not the picture we want painted of ourselves. And anyone who loves horse racing knows the horse comes first. And I think that's been said brilliantly by people over the week, like Kevin Blake and Ted Walsh on RTE, and even Johnny there before me. So that's the kind of opinion we want there, that the horse is first and that welfare is not an issue in racing. This is just a moment of madness that anyone could happen to absolutely anybody. It just happened that his was captured on camera and painted around the place and painted in a bad way.
Well said. That's Dave. Thank you for that, Dave. I appreciate that. Okay, we'll talk to you again next week. Cheers. Dave Weldon there giving us his thoughts, and I agree with them. You know, it didn't look good for horse racing, and nobody's denying that in any way, shape or form. And of course, we don't want to see that, but it is important to stress that the horse does come first. And as he said, it was just a moment and a poor decision. And let's leave it at that and move on. Okay, the Lucky 15, for those of you who are interested in it. In Kelso, we go to first with My Drogo in the 130. Then we're looking at Newbury for Killer Clown in the 150. Then the 240 is Cloth Cap back to Kelso for that one. And then Zoffy in Doncaster for the 255. We'll put that up on our social media channels as well. Okay, time to go over to our good old buddy Ken Doherty over in the UK. Hey, Ken, how are you?
Hi, Reg. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Hard luck during the week, bud. Hard luck. It was, we were all chomping at the bit for you.
I know. It got close. It was close, all right. Yeah, particularly when I led 2-0 against Selby and probably should have gone 3-0. Missed a chance then. And, of course, he came back, played very strong in the end, making a couple of centuries, yeah. But it was close. It was nice to play him, though, you know, on the TV. And that was a great challenge. And the next one for me now is the qualifying of the World Championship. Jimmy White did very well yesterday. He beat Stuart Bingham.
Yeah.
And he's back in action today. And, of course, we had the comeback of Stephen Hendry as well, the 7-time world champion, his first match in almost 10 years as a pro.
Got a century in the second frame, wasn't it? He got
a century in the second frame, yeah. A 776th century. but, unfortunately, it was the only frame he won. He started a little bit rusty. And... lost 4-1, you know, but good to see him back, to be honest, you know.
Absolutely, no, everybody was delighted, I think, to see him back. He got loads of great tributes as well from Ronnie and loads of other people, so it was great to see him back. What way is it panning out? So we still have Mark Allen, don't we?
Mark Allen's in there. There's still quite a few. Joe Trump is in there. Mark Selby actually lost last night, and he was in the running for this 150,000 bonus. It's sort of the Bet Victor series, so there's a series of tournaments where the player who goes deeper in all the events gets 150 bonus. So it was between him and Joe Trump. They were supposed to meet in the semi-finals, and that may determine who was going to get the bonus. So Joe Trump was probably rubbing his hands with glee last night. Max Elby's got out. Joe Trump is still in, so he will collect the bonus as well as whatever prize money is on offer this week as well, you know.
Not bad. For those prizes.
Yeah, no, it'd be nice for them. Prefer to do the radio with you. So
much better option, all right.
What about John Higgins last week, though, his performance? I mean, he beat Jordan Brown 6-0. He beat Corrin Wilson 6-0, who only scored 14 points, I think. Then he beat Selby 6-0, who only scored 7 points against him.
I know.
And then Ronnie O'Sullivan in the final 10-3. It was a demolition of... demolition of unbelievable sorts and creating records along the way. It was fantastic, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And he needed a few of the vitamins he's on.
I don't know whether they could do that for me, but he's changed his sort of cue action, done something sort of technically. I said to him, half of the tour will be on to him, rigging him up, find out what he's done exactly. But he was definitely inspired. It was incredible, you know.
And, okay, so Gibraltar Open, talk to me. Who are your picks? Where are we going with this one?
I think Trump is probably... Trump, Allen, you know, Sean Murphy is in there as well. Yeah. He's living back in Dublin now as well. He's playing really, really well. So he could cause an upset there. And, well, it'd be nice to see him. Because O'Sullivan's not in it, Higgins not in it.
Yeah.
But Trump is the main man. Robertson was knocked out. Ding was knocked out.
Jimmy's still in there.
I'd love to see Jimmy. I've been practicing with him quite a bit, as you know, and staying with him and stuff. And he's been playing really well. I'd love to see him get a run. He deserves it, you know. He's been such a great ambassador for the game over the years. You know, grew up watching him play Higgins, you know, all those years ago.
Yeah.
And he's still going on. He has the ripe old age of, like, what is he, 56, coming up to 57 this year. And I'd love to see him have a deep run. You know, he deserves it.
Yeah, no question about it.
What
about other sports during the week? So obviously,
I know
it's been a busy old week. I know you're into your horse racing. It was
tough week
for Gordon.
It is a very tough week for Gordon. But to be honest, Reg, you know, I've been listening to your interviews there with Dave and the broadcast. I thought they were very, very good, very honest. You know, when I saw Forrest, I was disgusted. You know, absolutely disgusted. Because if I own that animal myself and I'm an animal lover, love horses, dogs, whatever, I was totally disgusted. And then sort of on reflection, you know, I felt sorry for him. And I still feel sorry for him. But I think the 6-month ban is fair. You know, I think, you know, he held his hand up second time around. He should have held his hand up the first time and said, look, I did something wrong here and I deserve to. And I think 6 months, you know, is not a bad ban. I know he got 6 months suspended, but it could have been a lot worse because I know a lot of people were, you know, the noise were out for him completely. And he could have been banned even longer, you know. So I think a six-month ban is heavy enough, but it's sort of fair enough because it was an act of stupidity, a moment of stupidity, and he's going to pay the price for it. Well, he held his hand up yesterday and said, look, I'll pay the price. I'm happy to take the six-month ban. They gave me a fair hearing, and fair play to him for that, you know. And I hope, as you said, the most important thing, because we have this problem in our own sport with abuse online, you know, when people are... Because people are backing his horses, they're backing snooker players, but when they lose, and I saw a tweet to Mark Williams last night when he lost, and it was absolutely disgusting, you know, and that's the serious side behind it. There has to be some sort of regulations on social media as regards the abuse that sports people and other people are getting online. It's just not right. So I wish Gordon well. Yeah. He's been a great trainer, a great service to the industry, and he does a great job there, you know, with all the staff and stuff. And he's very, very well liked in the industry as well, you know. And yeah. I just hope he'll be okay. He'll come back stronger, and it will make him a stronger person. Let's hope. That's the main thing, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more. Just a quick word on tomorrow, the big derby.
I'm not looking forward to it at all.
You're worried?
It's one of those games you're not looking forward to. They had a terrible game against Crystal Palace during the week, and no, they're not playing that well at all. They're losing points left, right, and centre.
Sometimes you can just pull it out for one of those big
games. Yeah, they can. I mean, it's one of those games where it gets the juices flowing, you know, for the players. And they're playing a lot of matches, but City are just absolutely flying at the moment, aren't they? You know, and Everton, you know, Chelsea, I think Chelsea are going to be, they probably finish above United the way they're playing at the moment. I thought they played really well against Liverpool the other night, and they're a danger. I think the race for the top four is really as close as it's ever been. It's going to be very, very exciting, you know, towards the end. But yeah, big match for United. I think a big match, they need a big performance, United. Whether they can do it against City or not, I don't know. But they need a big performance very, very quickly. Get that confidence back, you know.
No question about it. Mm. Okay. What have you got this week? You said you're preparing for the Worlds, is it?
Yeah, the Worlds is April the 7th.
Yeah.
April the 7th, yeah. So back on the practice table.
Look at John Higgins. Get your inspiration.
I might be ringing John Higgins up to see what sort of technical shit.
Get that new bridge or cueing technique he has. Get that going. Yeah. All right. Mind yourself over there.
Have a great weekend.
You too. Okay. Take care.
Yeah. Take care. Bye-bye.
Our own Ken Doherty over at Milton Keynes giving us all the latest from the snooker that's going on over there. And it's the Gibraltar Open that's going on at the moment. And 57-year-old Jimmy White still in the running. Now, time to turn our attention to rugby. And delighted to be joined by my former teammate and good friend and former Leinster and Ireland legend, Shane Byrne. Good morning, bud. How are you?
Morning, Reg. How are you, man?
Very good, thanks. Very good. Like, I have to say, it was quite a positive week last week in the rugby. I enjoyed every single bit of it. We discussed beforehand what Ireland need to do and how they need to look and whether they were on to a hide and to nothing. But I think an awful lot of positives came out of that game last week for Ireland.
Yeah, I'd agree. I suppose on a side note, we should say, God, Italy were poor.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it really is a shame that over the last few years, the one thing you would say, they've had a lot of, you know, heroic losses with fighting, you know, like crazy with big defensive efforts and only getting pipped at the post or something like that. But now it seems to completely flipped on its head, is that their defence has gone desperately poor, but their attack has improved. It's an awful pity that the two hasn't come together.
Yeah.
But from an Irish point of view, yeah, it was, listen, one of those games that you... you know, there's not much to be gained, really, if you win or lose or whatever. It's about the performance and how they came about the win, and they did it well. It was great to see the offloading game coming back into us. A lot of people giving out outside of Leinster about the Leinster backline. But it certainly encouraged the players to play like they do for the provinces. And, you know, it's very, very good to see. And as you said, like a lot of positives, and Casey and Baird getting off for their first caps as well, which is great to see young lads coming through.
Yeah, and in terms of the giving out about the All Leinster backline, where are they picking holes in it? I mean, after a performance like that.
Well, no, that's like the people were given out before the game that the selection of a pure Leinster backline. You know what I mean? But that's just the way. Yeah, that's just the way it fell about, because he has been moving the backline around, but like you couldn't argue against any of the players there. Really, they were superb. Particularly Keane, the fullback, I think deserves a good mention. Gary Ringrose, great to see him back in a good bit of tension, grabbed the game by the scruff of the neck a couple of times. And Henshaw's work rate is just, I think he's the hardest working centre out there at the moment. And good to see Johnny Sexton hitting a bit of form again.
Yeah, absolutely. He was. He looked to be quite in control, albeit against very poor opposition. As we said, it is poor opposition. Where do you see it going next? I mean, huge game up next, of course.
Yeah. Up in Scotland, it's hard to say. I tell you one thing that definitely wouldn't have wanted to happen. Scotland are raging that French game was called off, because there's been a lot of good things coming out of the Scottish camp recently, and they're full of confidence. You know, very unlucky, you would have said, in that loss against Wales, and you know, they're at home. They're going to be a seriously, seriously hard team to beat. And so...
Is this the real tester for us now, Shane? You know, I mean, look, Wales, a poor performance. You know, France, I still think a poor performance, although the scoreline maybe flattered us a little bit. We played against a team of non-issues last week, let's call a spade a spade, and now we're going to Scotland. And this is a Scottish team that have found form again and play a very, very good brand of rugby. And I agree with you, you know, should have won. They were just very unfortunate with the...
rest again. Off again.
So, you know... What does he do? Do you think he'll pick the same team? How does he go about this one? Because the pressure is massive for this Scottish game.
It is. Well, firstly, I think the thing about this is the best way of defining this game is quite simply, it is in Ireland's hands. I think that's going to be the problem with it, where you're saying it is a really important big game. And it is, because it's going to be a direct reflection of where we are. If we play well, we will win this game. And if we don't, we will definitely lose this game. I know that's a really silly way of putting it, but that's the quality you're up against. You know,
you can't kind of bluff your way through this one, is what you're saying. You know, you can't have a mediocre performance and still get a win.
No, because Scotland definitely have the firepower that unless we play well, they will beat us. And there's no in-between on that. Like, they have amazing talent, as we all know. Some of the most creative broken field runners and playmakers that there are out there. But, you know, we still have the ability to beat them. That's the thing with this. The flashes that we've seen, you know, the middle 20, middle 40, you could almost say, against Wales, you know, part of the game against France, getting back within reach and touch and distance, you know, take parts of the offloading play from Italy. And if we put that all together, we definitely have the ability to beat the Scottish team over there. But again, it's going to be a great litmus test, because you know, we still have a few decisions to make. A lot of people came in, put their hands up right the way across the team. I personally, you know, the back row again was incredible, as Irish back rows nearly always are, and the you know, the competition there is huge. It was hard on Reece Ruddock. I don't like seeing Tadhg Byrne being moved out of the second row. I thought he was absolutely outstanding in the second row. And why would you? I think it lessens his worth when you put him to back row. But then again, he's fantastic in the back row. But we have some fantastic players there as well. And everyone came, great to see Tadhg Furlong back. Would he be in with a shout with the amazing Porter? Although they're talking about switching him over to Loosehead. Yeah. You know,
well, he was a Loosehead originally, you know.
He was, yeah.
I remember when he came to Leinster, you know, they converted him just purely because they had Key in there and they needed tight heads, you know. So I get why they did that, but I mean, it would be easy enough for him to switch back to Loosehead.
You would hope it wouldn't affect his form, because he has had an outstanding, you know, what you could say, season and a half now when Tadhg was away. Because, you know, as you well know, you know, you only become a good prop by playing prop a lot at the highest level and learning all the tricks of the trade. So that's going to be interesting. But Dave Kilcoyne was, you know, he deserved a spot too. And Keane Healy, you know, is he going to be starter? You know, do you take him off the bench? Amazing guy to have off the bench. Are we even talking at that stage yet? Does he just go with all his tried and trusted? You know, yeah, I think if O'Mahony coming back into the mix as well, you know, does he deserve to get in within talk as well? Will Connors, amazing player, amazing game. But Van der Fleer had one of the most standout performances against Wales, and all of a sudden finds himself out. There's so many of these debates. In fact, it's probably ironically the back line is probably way more settled.
Yeah,
you know, there's you know, Earls, did he, you know, does he deserve a chance to get back in? Because Larmour did excellent. In fact, I a lot of the work that Larmour did didn't go noticed, I thought, in the game, that he, you know, some injections of pace drawing defenders in, you know, again, part of that offload game.
Yeah, it's interesting. It'll be very interesting to see which way it pans out in terms of what he selects. But no doubt, I think one of the most crucial games that Ireland have had to face coming up against Scotland. I saw a bit of chat there as well, talking about Farrell and the Lions tour. I don't think we need that type of distraction at the moment. Jeez, like, he needs to focus on his job at hand, very much so.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And he came out with the right words going, absolutely. And I'm thinking of just Ireland and stuff like that. But the Lions is going to be odd this year, you know, if it is, goes ahead. Now, personally, I would much prefer it to be postponed to 2022. Yeah. But obviously, World Rugby is trying to do as little disruption as possible, because I don't think a Lions tour is something that should be just box ticked. We'll just get the fixtures done. I think it's all about the tour, the supporters, the crowd. It's about that. Personally, I'd push it out. But anyway, that Farrell could end up, it could be just a month's gig, like one month, there you go. They get together and then they're gone again. So, yeah, it's been a strange week for headlines. I suppose the main talking point really last week was the referee. You know, like every week in the Six Nations, there's been some absolute howlers.
At least they came out and held their hand up in this occasion, and it was reviewed. And I think that's a good thing to see. It was reviewed, it was dealt with, and they came out and admitted, you know, fault, which can happen, I suppose, in live sports. That's the way it is.
But listen, I don't know what way they're interacting with the TMOs and things like that, because I find it poorer now, because the TMO, obviously, look, the structure is correct, but I just think it's not been managed correctly, that, you know, TMO is interfering for the slightest thing and, you know, pulling the game back and you know, the TMO should only stop play if it's an absolute howler that's been missed, you know. And for those two tries that for Wales, you know, one of them in particular, absolutely madness. Yeah. Madness. First, go ahead. To have the facilities that they have now and to still make that decision, it baffles belief, you know. But then again, Wales, Triple Crown. Is it unbelievable?
Yeah, they've won a Triple Crown on refereeing decisions.
To be honest, that's it. And, like, you know, in fairness, there's been some flashes of good play from them as well.
Oh, yeah.
But that's it. That's about it. You know, nothing more that deserves that. And the absolute howlers by refs to create the decisions that they did. But, you know, there's some amazing stats coming out that Wales haven't had a card in a couple of seasons against them. And everyone else has against them, yellows and reds and stuff like that. And you know, one thing is that of all the talismanic leaders out there, Alwyn Jones in the Northern Hemisphere is probably the most important, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely.
And I'm just throwing that out there, that I you know, maybe it's just no coincidence that the last of the great rugby captains that's around at the moment is him, and their team is the only team that hasn't been carded. I think it's something like 14 games. It's madness. Absolute madness.
I know. And they're going in now, like, with an unbelievable chance. They're away to Italy next.
Oh, you said.
So the Grand Slam is well and truly up for taking. And
it just
beggars belief that Wales could win a Grand Slam. Out of, like, everybody talking in going into it. Wayne Pivak's job was on the line. They haven't got any players, they're all injured. They haven't got any structure. Welsh rugby is falling apart. Their province or teams can't win a game against anybody. And here they are. Like, I have no doubt they'll be going for a Grand Slam in the final week.
Oh, they will, of course. Yeah. They will, of course. Yeah. Like, you know, in fairness, unfortunately, Italy aren't going to.
You can stop them
because, you know, as you said, they have a load of players coming back. Yeah. You know, they're actually getting better potentially as they go on, because they haven't shown any great shakes to this point. But yeah, absolutely, the jammiest Triple Crown or whatever it's called. Considering how hard everyone else has to work for it, but I suppose we should say fair play to them and all that. But.
Oh yeah, but they're the rich, and we love to give them a hard time. Okay, looking at the provinces. So I mean, last night's game, Munster and Connacht. Yeah. Good to see Joey Carberry back, and it was ultimately his penalty kick that won the game for Munster in the end. A close game, no question about it. But that's Munster in the final, as we all expected. And Leinster can sort of do it again tonight if they can beat Ulster and get their in the final with them.
Yeah, now, am I right in saying the Connacht, I think, are online to get Europe as well, which is fantastic, because they got 2 bonus points out of that. Yeah, great game last night, I have to say. They really went at it, and it was very interesting to see. Connacht had obviously put a lot of work into the set piece against Munster, which is obviously traditionally their strong point. And they really took advantage of it. So, yeah, Connacht or Munster really had to dig deep. Probably a very, very strong bench that they had was the difference in the end, really, for Munster. But, yeah, now we're now in the situation with this strange season that we're in, that we're so close to Munster now. We're definitely into the final. And it's a shortened season, should I say. And then you have the game today where Ulster have a minute chance of still Pippin Leinster, and they have to get one over them this tonight or forget about it. Unfortunately, that's just out of their line. Like, and it is the way it's been made this year. It is ironic that Ulster will probably finish with more points than Munster and still not be in the final. You know, it's amazing the way it works out.
No, it is odd, all right. They're both on 54 as it stands at the moment. But as you said, Ulster have a game in hand, so if they can get a bonus point, you're right, they will end up with more points. So it is odd, no question about it. I suppose just the final note that I'd have then, we touched on the Lions. Your feeling is, it seems to be getting the green light, and they're trying to find ways around hosting it and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Do you think they'll go? I'm just worried that if they push it out for another year, I agree with you, it'd be nice to have a proper Lions tour and push it out for another year, but there's so many other sports and fixtures. I mean, you look at the Olympics, I just don't see them going to different things. Everything could get pushed and pushed and pushed to next year, and there might not be any space for it.
Yeah, well, look, there is that. But the problem is that, you know, World Rugby trying to cause as little ripple effects throughout the seasons. But, you know, it is messed up. The whole seasons have been messed up. So, you know, the Lions is more than just a couple of fixtures that need doing. You know, it's not like a summer tour that, look, we just get them done. You know, it's not about that. It's far more than that. It's back to the traditional values, the crowds, you know. I know I've mentioned all that before, but it does mean something, you know. And, you know, in a Lions year, I love all these debates come out of every 4 years. Oh, will the Lions survive in the modern era? Like, ridiculous. Like, every year that the Lions is on, the Lions jersey is up there in the top one or two jerseys sold in the world that year. Yeah. You know, it's crazy, that chat. And I just feel that, you know, just ticking the box and bringing South Africa and cocooning them up in London and playing a couple of tests in England, I just feel it wouldn't be right. You know what I mean? It's almost making it bad.
The thing about the Lions is the touring, isn't it? I mean, that's...
Of course it is.
You know, and it's that it's kind of like... it's a slog that you have to come through and you have to battle through and go through all of the different fixtures around and meeting different places and bringing the brand to different places and the players to meet different cultures and all that kind of stuff. Like, that's not, like you said, ticking a box and playing a few games, that's not the thing. It's not, dare I say it, and I love the Babas, but it's not the Babas that you can just throw a match on and people will watch it and there you go, it's done. It's got much more to it than that.
No, like, the formula of it is that it's meant to be the best of the Northern Hemisphere going down to the Southern Hemispheres on their patch, so that's their advantage. But you're bringing down the cream of the crop from the Northern Hemisphere, so that's meant to even it off. Now, there's huge problems with putting those teams together, as we all know, but that's the formula that works. And bringing South Africa up to the Northern Hemisphere and just ticking a box and playing these games, you know, I think it would be a shame. Look, there'll still be an amazing spectacle, whatever they decide to do. But my personal one would that it, as an event, the Lions is a big enough event to stand alone against a lot of other sporting events that could be on. And I think it could very much be a flagship of 2022, you know.
Excellent stuff. Okay, Shane, as always, great chatting to you. You mind yourself.
All right, take care, man.
Take care. That's Shane Byrne there, former Leinster, Ireland, Lion. Anything you want to throw at him, he has them all. Giving us his chats there on the rugby and opinion on everything that's going on. Now, my next guest is Meath All Ireland winner Vicky Wall. She's been named as the Intermediate Players Player of the Year in TG Cahir's Ladies Football Awards programme, Pelling Them On. And I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Vicky this morning. Good morning, Vicky. How are you?
Morning. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. Congratulations on your recent award. It must be feeling good now at this stage.
Yeah, definitely. It was a huge honour, so absolutely delighted, Joe.
Yeah, I just wanted to get you on this morning just to talk about, we cover ladies football a huge amount here on the show on a weekly basis, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about Meath in general, because we're good friends with Bernard Flynn. He's been on here many times talking to us about the struggles that the men are having in the game, but you're having good success, but it has been a bit of a rocky road to get here. You were saying in your recent interview that in 2017 you were having to phone people up to try and get them around to training.
Yeah, look, absolutely. I mean, I joined the panel in 2015, I think it was. I was 16, and I suppose we were struggling to get a lot of players. And it was a transitional period. A lot of people retired at the same time, and, you know, they'd been stalwarts for me. They'd given 10 years of commitment. So, no, absolutely nobody begrudged them, but it was a tough time to try and get a group of girls back together. And, you know, a lot of people were travelling and stuff like that. So I think the first 2 years I was playing, I think I drew one match. And other than that, we kind of lost every single match. And we went from senior in Division 2 to intermediate in Division 3 in my first 2 years playing. And then now, thankfully, we're back up Division 2 and senior. But it's definitely been... it's been a journey anyway to get back up.
And Vicky, tell me, how did you encourage the rest of the players to get involved or get them back at it, let's say?
I think a huge part of it boiled down to the management. So Eamon Murray from Boards Mill and then Paul Gargan from Meath. So Eamon would have been involved with Meath set up all through the years. You know, football is his life. So he would have had really good relationships with a lot of the players, and he kind of approached a lot of girls, and he had Paul by his side, who had a really good plan and knew exactly where he wanted to take us. So I think just having the both of them together really helped people believe in what they wanted to achieve.
Yeah, and I know there's been huge work been done in recent years with the GAA in the development of the game. Is it through the schools mostly or the club scene that you're seeing the involvement or participation?
I think it's both. I think it starts in the schools, obviously, and kind of encourages it from there. So I know even in Dunboyne, the nursery numbers are huge, and it's great to see. And we've got the chance to go up a few times and give a handout and stuff like that. So it's unbelievable to see. And the numbers are growing hugely since we amalgamated with the men's club a few years ago. So, yeah, I think it starts in the schools, and then hopefully it spreads out to the clubs from there.
Yeah, it wasn't the easiest of road to get that final win. You'd go through the heartbreak of losing a couple of times, first of all.
Yeah, definitely. Look, we lost in 2018 to Tyrone, who were worthy winners, and then 2019 to Tipperary, who I think were worthy winners as well. Unfortunately, we kind of got a bit closer against Tip, but it was just those last few minutes of, and they got goal chances and they took them, and we probably didn't. So I think definitely a lot learned from those 2 years, and I think I think this year we kind of played with a fearless kind of attitude. You know, we'd lost two All-Irelands. We knew life went on, as painful as it was, the weeks after losing those All-Ireland finals. You kind of, you don't have a choice. You have to get on with it, even though your head's probably breaking after losing two All-Ireland finals in Croke Park. But that was definitely a big driving force for us this year.
Tell me, are you encouraged by the support that Ladies GA is getting these days? I mean, looking at the finals now, I know there's been some in the senior, there's been some classic encounters between the likes of Dublin and Cork over the years, and they're getting 40 and 50,000 people getting into to Croke Park. Is that type of thing really encouraging for everybody else down along the ranks?
It definitely is. And, you know, Croke Park, obviously, it's the pinnacle of the year. You want, everyone wants to be there. And when you get those kind of crowds, it's so encouraging. But I'd love to see that spread more throughout the year. You know, that kind of way of, I think it's great. We're getting more opportunities. We're getting into stadiums more these days. But I just think if we could get that at every single match, you know, that same type of support, and just even comparing it to Park Talta when you go for one of the men's matches and stuff like that, I'd just love to see it being filled up to the same extent. So we're on the right track, I think, but I still think there is a gap in attendance.
What do you think the key to that is? More TV coverage, although TG Carr do a massive coverage as it is.
Yeah, I actually felt even this year the fact that a lot of the games were live streamed on Facebook or broadcast on TG Carr, it gave much more exposure to the game, because I suppose even for us county players, if we're playing on a Sunday, we're probably not going to be doing a lot of travelling on a Saturday to go and watch different matches. So to be able to watch all those matches from home was phenomenal, and you kind of got to watch every single grade. So whether it was junior or senior, a lot of the games were broadcasted. So I think that really helped, and if that could continue, I think when we are allowed back at games, I think it will encourage a lot more people to attend, because I think a lot more people got to watch the games this year.
Absolutely. No doubt about it, and the quality is just unbelievable. I've watched on regular occasions, and you know, I don't want to sound condescending, but I think a lot of people maybe who are new to the sport, they're surprised sometimes at the quality. I mean, that's not meant in any way as an insult. I think it's just because it's not getting so much exposure, as much exposure as it should do, that when people actually come to the game, they go, "My God, I wasn't expecting to be as good as it was."
Yeah, I think it's just getting people to one game even. I know in Dunboyne we have a loyal supporter of a good few older men who probably wouldn't have been at women's matches for a lot of years, and now they wouldn't miss one of our matches, whether it's a league match at the opposite side of the county or a championship match. They will be there, and they'll be in the club bar after to tell you what you did right and what you did wrong. So I suppose I think it is just, like you said, the exposure and getting more people there. And I think once they're there, they'll see the quality and they'll see the standard, and I don't think they'll be turned off anyway.
Our lads in the bar telling you what you did wrong is for both sports. That doesn't change.
That's
both sports, I can promise you that. Tell me, you were telling in your recent interview as well that I watched that it wasn't always easy. There's been a couple of difficult years for you as well, where you were subject to kind of harsh comments and a bit of abuse maybe from the sideline.
Yeah, look, I suppose I mentioned it in the TG Carr one. I probably didn't put a huge amount of thought in beforehand. I didn't think it would get the response it has at all.
Yeah.
But, yeah, look, I put on a fair bit of weight during my leaving third year. You know, I'm definitely not the first person to have done that, but it definitely affected my game and how I could play and even just my fitness levels, and of course it does. But I suppose when you're insecure about something yourself and then there's people external to you mentioning it in games, obviously that kind of hits a nerve and it affects you a lot more. Whereas now I think after, you know, I'm a lot more confident in myself, and just even I know the work that I put in to get this place. So I think now I'm kind of, I wouldn't take offensive, but I think at that time I was probably vulnerable. So I think that's why it probably took more of, it had more of an impact on me.
And do you find yourself now, because of your success in sport, being somewhat of a role model and a spokesperson, let's say, to other girls that might be looking for advice from you?
I don't know. It's kind of a hard one. I think you kind of, I wouldn't really think about that a huge amount, but I suppose the reaction that it's had this week, and even just a few younger girls reaching out to me on Instagram and stuff, like, I definitely wouldn't have expected that. But even I know there's a player, I can't think of her name, and Tyrone, who spoke out this week as well. Yeah. About abuse she was subject to, I think it was in a newspaper article. So look, if it gets a bit more conversation and it kind of just gets a bit more attention brought to the subject, that it's just maybe not acceptable, and we talk about dropout rates of young girls in sport, and I mean, I was 20, 21, and you kind of, if I maybe didn't have such a love for sport, would I have probably given up because of that? Yeah, definitely. Like, so I think it's important to bring a bit of awareness to it. Yeah.
How has it been with this horrendous COVID training wise and getting prepared for this season?
Yeah, I think I'm kind of used to it now at this stage. I suppose the first lockdown definitely was a bit strange, you know, going out and trying to get a session that was up to par with a county session that you're doing by yourself or that kind of stuff. So, but I think we get used to it now. We're all on individual programs. We all have goals to achieve. So it's the same type of thing as if we'd all be together. But I suppose we have the likes of Zoom and stuff like that. But yeah, it's definitely not the same. But I suppose it's something to keep us going.
How are the squad looking for this campaign?
Yeah, really good. I suppose most of us are sticking together and we've a young enough squad and stuff like that that we've been there a few years together. So I think there's a really good base and we've a lot of new minors in with us this year. So I think that's huge. And I know there's phenomenal talent coming up in the under 14 and 16 ranks in Meath as well. So it's an exciting time.
And finally, of course, your sister Sarah did her ACL. How's she getting on? How's her recovery?
Yeah, look, it's tough, I suppose. It's the second one she's done, and she did the first one in TY, so she missed a bit of our All-Ireland success with Dunboyne as well. So definitely tough seeing her go through it again. I probably felt a bit guilty with the whole awards, and obviously she's going through that, so it's definitely... I appreciate how tough it is for her, but she's an absolute warrior, so I'm no doubt she'll be doing her rehab, and she'll get back to, I'd say, even better than she was, so yeah.
Well, Sarah, we wish you the very best of luck with that as well. And Vicky, it was wonderful talking to you. Really enjoyed that. Good luck with the season and good luck with everything. Keep up the good work and we'll chat to you again soon, hopefully.
Thanks a million.
Take care. That's Vicky Wall there. Meath footballer, intermediate champions, of course, giving us all her insight. And she recently received her award as the Players Player of the Year on the TG Carr programme, Pelnamon. So congratulations to her. Okay, time to turn our attention to football now. Delighted to be joined on the line by the one and only Alan Cawley. Good morning, Al. How are you?
Morning, Reggie. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Doing well. So I'm actually getting excited now because we have a World Cup to look forward to. We're going to be bidding for it. It's going to be 45,000 seater stadiums in Galway, Sligo. You know, Mbappe and these lads are all going to be lashing around the place. It's going to be great.
I was looking at some of the stuff doing the rounds and the politicians jumping on the bandwagon, particularly the local ones. And as you said, the one down in Galway really tickled me about the stadium they're going to build down there for this. Yeah. Any chance of them building a stadium for the domestic football? I'm worrying about the stuff that is most kind of present and the concerns that they have here with Irish football instead of worrying about stuff 9 years down the line, like, you know?
I know. It is a bit of a... There's no reason in the world why we can't host part of a World Cup here. I don't doubt that for any minute. But, you know, talking about building white elephant stadiums kind of make me laugh a little bit.
Absolutely, yeah. And then, to be fair, the Euros, we were going to be hosting, I think, 4 games this summer. That looks obviously like it's not going to happen now because of the pandemic. And I think it's already, it might have been announced during the week or it's about to be announced anyway, but it looks like we're going to lose them. So yeah, we're capable of hosting games, absolutely. And if it was to happen, but there's a lot more pressing matters at Irish football in the present time, Reggie, than worrying about stuff, as I say, 9 years down the line, and as you said, building white elephants all around the country.
Yeah. Absolutely, okay. We'll turn our attention to the Premier League, more importantly. It's really hotting up in terms of the top four situation. Liverpool we'll start with because it's just the main topic of story and so many of our listeners are so interested. And I think there's two stories going on there at Liverpool at the moment. First of all, it's quite incredible how much they were dependent on their defence and how it's fallen to pieces through injuries. And then there's the other side, which seems to be that there's the likes of Salah and these guys who are unhappy in the club and are talking about leaving, and they can't really afford to lose the likes of him, a talisman like him. So there's more to it than meets the eye going on at Liverpool at the minute.
Absolutely, Reggie. Yeah, it's gone past the stage now. The current run of form that they're in, it's certainly gone past the stage of just associating it all down to Van Dijk being injured or Gomez being injured or whoever, you know. The run of form, they still have a squad of players, regardless of one or two injuries, to key players that they're still capable of picking up games in the games that they've played. And to be on the run of form that they're in, they've only won one out of the last five. And at home, I think they've lost five in a row for the first time in years. So they're on a really bad run of form. And as you say, on top of the injuries, whatever's going on with the front three, you'd allow for them, obviously, because they've been so reliant on them, you'd allow for them having some bad games. And, of course, you'd put up with that. But I think Jota's been a huge miss in that regard, relating to those top three, because they've had to literally rely on them. And they've been on the go now for 2 or 3 years. But I think you're right to bring up the Salah thing, because taking him off after an hour the other night, it certainly surprised me. I have a view on Salah where he looks to me, Reggie, like the type of player that it's all about him. That's all he's worried about. He looks quite selfish. Mm. Whereas you look at Mane and Firmino, I always think they play more for the team. And certainly in the Salah situation. Now, nobody can argue with the goals, and he's the top scorer again this year. He's been an amazing player for Liverpool. But he just strikes me as the type of fella who, even if Liverpool lost, he wouldn't bother him all that. Well, obviously, he'll bother him, but once he scores, he's one of those fellas that's all he's concerned about. When he took him off the other night, it surprised me, because I've seen Salah have some bad games, and when he doesn't score, he's not really contributing a whole lot. Yeah. That certainly wasn't one of those games the other night. He was doing okay in the match. So for him to take him off after an hour, I don't know, is it a show of authority from Klopp because of stuff that might be going on behind the scenes to more or less send a message that I'm the boss around here, I'm the manager, whatever the case may be. But Salah certainly didn't look happy. There's a lot of murmurings from the agent that's involved as well. As we all know about agents now and the prominent role they play, I think he put out a bit of a cryptic tweet as well. So it certainly looks like they could lose Salah, and that would be a disaster for them because he's been such a great player for them. But there's certainly more problems at Liverpool than just the injuries at the moment.
There's an interesting photo in the Irish Daily Star today of Salah, and it's a picture of him after he was subbed off, sitting in the, you know, the red leather chairs that they have, and he's got the arms folded, he's slumped, and the mask is down around his chin. And, you know, you're kind of saying to yourself, there's a real photograph of defiance almost. You know, I'm not even going to wear the mask. I know the cameras will be on me. I know I'm supposed to wear the mask, but I'm not even going to wear the mask. You know, that's sort of a petulant...
Like a spoiled brat, Reggie.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. We've all been there when someone gets on to you and you have that face on you where you're not happy and you're sitting there like a spoiled brat.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've always found that. And even if you go back, I remember the time there was a bit of a row. Now, look, we all have rows with teammates and different things. But I remember there was a major one with Mane when he wouldn't pass Salah. He felt Salah wouldn't pass to him. And he came off absolutely fuming, Mane, against Burnley. I think that was last season it might have been there. And I remember Jordan Henderson having to calm him down. So it just looks like there might be a bit more going on. And Salah, of course, as I say, the fact that Klopp took him off, your top scorer, when they're crying out for a goal. And they just look so toothless at the moment, Liverpool, that they've been really disappointing. I know Roy Keane called them bad champions. I probably wouldn't go that far because there's been such an impact on the squad with injuries, and that has to affect the squad. But certainly in terms of their energy levels and their intensity, they're just not playing anywhere near to the level of what we'd associate with them over the past 18 months, 2 years.
Yeah, okay. Look, at the start of the season, you spoke about Chelsea. You really fancied them. They're starting to come good, playing some lovely football, no question about that. They have a cracking one with Everton on Monday night.
Yeah, Chelsea, and people were beginning to laugh at me, I think, when they were down around 9% after me giving them the big build-up. But even with Frank Lampard, I always felt they had a really good squad of players. Tuchel has obviously come in and he's absolutely hit the ground running, Reggie, and put on a brilliant performance against Liverpool. I know we said, and we've just touched on it there, that they weren't great in the game during the week, but I felt Chelsea did a job on them. They just looked like it was almost like a European team coming over and doing a job on them in a European tie. That they just were so comfortable tactically, they were far more superior. They looked dangerous on the counter every time they went forward, looked like scoring. And he's done a brilliant job, Tuchel. He's made it a clean slate for all the players. He's revitalised a few of them there. Rudiger, who wasn't really playing under Lampard, has come in and done a good job playing a back three. Jorginho looks like the main man now in front of the back three as well, alongside maybe Kante or Kovacic. Mason Mount has been a revelation. Now, he's been a revelation all year, to be fair to him. And even when Tuchel came in, he left him out in his first game because a lot of people were kind of going with the narrative that he was only playing because of Lampard. But that's nonsense, Reggie, because he's a serious talent, Mason Mount. And Tuchel now has played him in every match and he's relying on him. So they look really, really strong. They've gone into the fourth position, as you say, they have huge momentum with them. Should be a cracker against Everton. And of course, Everton are having a great season themselves, and it's no coincidence they have a brilliant manager, Reggie. And I know there's a lot of debate and discussion. We often chat about your beloved Arsenal with Arteta. I'm not gone on Solskjaer. But you look at the track record with Ancelotti and what he's done in his career. Amazing manager. So it's no coincidence to see the job he's done at Everton.
Absolutely not. No. They've had a good season, no question about it. And right, you know, that's what I'm saying. In terms of top four, what a cracking match.
Mm.
Points separating the two. Everton with the game in hand. you know, this could be Everton's season. That's how big that game is. You know, if they could somehow manage to get that win over Chelsea with that game in hand, leapfrog them into fourth place and finish out the season, there you go. Their job is done. So it's a huge, huge game, that Chelsea-Everton one.
Absolutely, yeah. And when you think at the start of the year, they invested a lot, fair enough. They had to bring in reinforcements, but he signed well with Alan and Decore. Richarlison has done very well. Calvert-Lewin's had a really good season. So the lad they brought in from Norwich has done brilliantly. Godfrey at the back. So they've done really, really well. And when you think their home form is really poor, Reggie, if they were to tighten up on the home form, they'd be up challenging maybe at the top of the table. So he's done a brilliant job, Ancelotti, and if they were to win on Monday night and, as you say, jump into the top four and maintain that, because you look at the Leicester and Man United at the moment, who are going through a bit of an indifferent form and struggling, and have a few injuries, particularly Leicester, they might begin to go on the slide a little bit. I wouldn't like to see that, because I think Rodgers has done a brilliant job. I'd love to see them finish in the top four, but the injuries now are beginning to impact them with Madison and Barnes. And then you look at United as well. Gary Neville came out with a great phrase, I thought, during the week, where the game against Crystal Palace, where they were really poor, he said they were sleepwalking themselves into a fight for top four now. Yeah. And it should have been the opposite, really, that they should have been just hanging on the coattails of Man City for as long as they could. But that race is well and truly over, as we know. And now they're in a fight to be in the top four, because, as you mentioned there, Chelsea and Everton, with the game on, like, they're the ones with all the momentum behind them at the moment and in great form.
And United, you mentioned it there, of course, they're going to be taking on City in that derby. And they're, like, Henderson's going to have to start and go because De Gea is not available. His baby, I think, isn't he? He's gone back to birth of a baby. So, I don't know, like, it's a fully fit City side against a kind of a strung together United side. It's hard to see it going any way except the home team.
Yeah, they've looked toothless in the last five games. They've only picked up one win and four draws, Reggie, so... United, they looked a bit flat and fatigued as well. The only defence I would make for all the teams and all the players, there's a hell of a lot of games, Reggie. Like, the schedule is really, really tough. Now, you'll always get people that'll argue they're getting well paid, the usual argument that gets thrown at them, but the schedule is really, really tough in terms of the amount of games that they're playing. Like, you flick on I'm even tired looking at the games. There's games on every night of the week, Reggie. Yeah. And it's tough going for them, particularly the ones in Europe as well. But look, that's par for the course. But they do look a little bit heavy-legged at the moment, United. I can't see them getting anything out of the Man City game. Man City are just too good, too strong. The luxury that they have is that the squad that they've built up, full of quality, is that they can rest and rotate players. And I suppose if the debate has turned out to kind of win everything. And I think the big thing that they'll have in their favour this year is the fact that they'll probably have the league wrapped up with four or five league games to go. Yeah. So they'll be able to just play out that resting players and concentrate solely on the Champions League and maybe the latter stage of the FA Cup at that stage. So it wouldn't put it past me at all to see them winning everything, but certainly in the game against United tomorrow, I just think there's too big of a gulf between the two teams.
Still a great chance for West Ham to get themselves up in there to top four. I think, you know, Leeds at home, it's a real opportunity for them to get 3 points.
Definitely, yeah. Moyes, as we keep saying every week, done a brilliant job, Reggie. Absolutely brilliant job. It's just incredible, really, the turnaround and form in the team, and even bringing in Lingard, adding to the good team they had already. Lingard has come in and done very well for them also. So it's a huge opportunity, yeah, if they beat Leeds. They're just on the coattails there of Everton and Chelsea and still in the race. I keep saying to you every week, I don't know, can I see them finishing in the top four? But even top six for West Ham, I think, would be a hell of a return for Moyes.
Absolutely, no question about it. Now, let's go down the other end, just because it's always good to keep an eye on that too. And I think real concern creeping in now for the likes of Brighton and Newcastle. Fulham, you know, they're only 3 points behind both of those teams, and Newcastle are a bit of a mess at the minute.
Yeah, and Fulham were lucky during the week because they've been on a decent run of form, a bit of momentum behind them. They played Spurs. Spurs were good in the first half, but it was all Fulham the second half, and that ridiculous rule with the accidental handball, which finally somebody has seen sense now, and they're going to take it away, I think, the end of the season. But they got a good goal ruled out, and that cost them a point. So they do have a little bit of momentum with them, Fulham, and they're as you say, they're breathing down the neck of Newcastle and Brighton, and they'll be looking over their shoulders. There's a huge game with Newcastle and West Brom this weekend. Even West Brom, Reggie, if they were to kick up that win, would put themselves back in the chase. Now, I thought it was a lost cause when Allardyce took over, and I still think it's a big ask. But the fact that Brighton and Newcastle are really, really struggling has given West Brom and Fulham a lot of hope at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely, no doubt about it. We'll just have to see how that pans out. See, I see over in Barcelona, still not getting any better over there. Arrests and investigations and CEOs and all sorts of stuff. We spoke about it a bit last week, but it's just gone from bad to worse, isn't it?
It's a club in crisis, Reggie. It really is. And never mind on the pitch, off the pitch, there's major, major problems, as we addressed last week, in terms of the club maybe going into bankruptcy and all sorts, as you say, board members getting arrested during the week and all sorts of stuff going on. It's sad to see, really. And like, you think of the last 10 years has been the Messi era and everybody lauding Barcelona and how good they've been, and particularly him. It's all going to end in tears, it looks like, because he's going to leave. The money that he's being paid, even though he's an amazing player, is probably going to cost the club their future. And the fact that it's all going to end in tears, considering it's been such a brilliant period for them, it's quite sad, really.
It is. And they have their away to PSG during the week in the Champions League. It's hard to see them getting anything out of that game. Liverpool, of course, are playing host to RB Leipzig. I expect them to win that one, but it's just so hard at the minute to know with everything that's going on there.
It is hard to know, but the fact that there's a two-goal cushion, I still fancy them to come through that. They were good. And that, it's funny, like, in that game, they were really good there a couple of weeks ago against Leipzig. I watched it. They played well. Now, albeit, the criticism of Liverpool at the moment is obviously that they can't score and they're struggling to create. Leipzig gifted them two goals that night as well, if you remember, Reggie. It was two bad mistakes by Leipzig, allowed Salah and Mane in to score. But the fact that the two-goal cushion still, I think, that should be enough to get Liverpool through in that one. Can I see them go on to win the Champions League in their current run of form? Absolutely no chance. I think the Champions League is going to boil down to City and Bayern and PSG this year, and they have an unbelievable chance, City. But there's a great game on in Germany today as well, Reggie. Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund at 5:30. So that's their big derby, and that should be a cracker as well. You look at the form, Haaland and Sancho and a few of them boys are in as well. And they could be dark horses for the Champions League, Borussia Dortmund, especially with Haaland up front. He's an amazing talent.
Absolutely. Okay, on to the important stuff. Callie's Call, the podcast.
It's We're back, Reggie. We're back next week, bigger and better. Isn't that what they say?
That's what they do, yeah. All the production values behind the big team that you have pushing it out there. So who have you got?
There you go, Reggie. Yeah, no, we have a couple of interviews lined up, surprise interviews, just to launch it next week. And then we'll be back with the regular Monday show every week that the league kicks off. Because, of course, the league is kicking off now on the 19th. We have the President's Cup next Friday, Dundalk against Shamrock Rovers, the curtain raiser. And then the following week, the first game of Shamrock Rovers against St. Pat's, which is on RT as well. And there's a few games the first few weeks live on RT and also on the streaming service. So finally, I'll be able to get out of the house and go to a match, Reggie, because I watched a match last night, Huddersfield and Cardiff. And I know Mick McCarthy's on a good run of form at the moment, but oh my God, it was dreadful, Reggie.
The things you have.
Dreadful it was. So,
through the elbows, trust me, I've had to cover a few games recently, the likes of Zebre against the Dragons and a few of these ones, and it's tough going. I feel your pain. It is tough going, Reggie.
Anyway, as
always, great to chat to you, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Reggie. Thank you.
That's brilliant. Alan Cawley there. And of course, his podcast is back next week. That's all we've got time for on this week's show. Thank you for listening to us here on Dublin's Talking Sport on Sunshine 106.8. With thanks to InsureMyVan.ie. Thanks, producer Blaine O'Hara. We'll be back again next week. Take care and stay safe.